This is an ABC podcast.
COVID-19 has dominated health conversations in the last 2 years and diverted our attention from the burden of chronic conditions. I'm Paul Barclay, and in this Big Ideas, a reminder that you are what you eat. We know eating well is important to our health, but just how important is the focus of this discussion from the University of New South Wales Faculty of Medicine and Health? It's estimated that 20,000 Australians die a preventable death each year because of an unhealthy diet. And that doesn't include feeling below par every day if your food isn't supplying all the ingredients your body needs to work at its best. ABC science journalist Tegan Taylor is speaking with Vanessa Mathiasen, Deloitte's National Consumer Products Lead and the lead author of their Future of Food series, and Jason Wu, University of New South Wales Professor and Head of Nutrition Science at the George Institute for Global Health.
Globally right now, about 11 million deaths, premature deaths, one in every five, is attributable to what we call suboptimal diet. So essentially eating not enough of the good things like fruits and vegetables and too much of the unhealthy things like sugary drinks, right? So that's the global picture. Australia is no different. So in terms of our top diseases that are imposing a severe burden on our healthcare, cardiovascular disease, type 2 diabetes, certain kinds of cancers, a lot of it is driven, again, by unhealthy diets. So for us as a society going forward, I mean, recently with the COVID pandemic, how much strain our healthcare has been put under as well. It's just not going to be sustainable unless we can get on top of this issue of suboptimal diets and make sure that we can really shift the whole population in the right direction.
Vanessa, how does that fit with the work that you're doing?
This industry that I work with every day, it's the retailers, their food producers, manufacturers, their agricultural companies. I'd like to actually think, as much as I agree with the picture that you paint, that they're not just a major problem, but there can actually be a solution. And it's a solution for a sustainable, healthy planet, but in particular, sustainable health of individuals.
So Jason, part of your work is modelling what different changes might equate to if we change things in the food supply. Where is the biggest bang for buck if we were going to make a change in Australia?
What drives our dietary choices, right, as obviously we're individuals, they make our own choices. It's kind of like an onion, actually.
Okay, so nice.
There are many layers.
It's fragrant.
To it, right? So you know, a good way to think about it is that, you know, obviously we need to have the knowledge, education to sort of know what foods are good for us and not good for us. But if you go one step further out from that, right, there's your family, there's the cultural influences around what is considered healthy foods, what you should be eating. If you go a little bit further out from that, right, at the community level, where you live, right, what postcodes and what area you're in, even if you had the right education and knowledge, can you actually afford to buy the healthy foods that are out there? Do you have a supermarket that's close to you that makes it easier for you to get to? Going further out from that, right, government policy around incentivizing the production of healthy foods versus less healthy foods, all the way through to global trade agreements and how that can influence the kind of foods that are accessible to us. It's complex, right? How do we actually help communities and populations improve their diet? And the short answer is that there's no one size solution that's going to fit it all. We need to have a solution targeted at the individual, at the community level, and also at the government societal level. And just some examples around that, right? We could reformulate our food products that are currently in the supermarkets, where we gradually take out some of the salt, gradually take out some of the added sugar. Over time, we can actually shift entire food supply in a healthier direction, right? That's a good example of the kind of thing that would be really good bang for our buck in terms of lifting everybody's health at the same time.
Yeah, I do want to talk in a little bit more detail about those big structural problems in a second, but at the individual level, because we'd like to at least think that we choose what we put into our bodies for the most part. Vanessa, you've talked about something called the intent gap between knowing what's healthy, knowing that and wanting to be healthy, but then what you actually end up doing is sometimes at odds with that.
Yeah, and one of the things that we love as well is a concept called behavioral economics, because I think that has a major role to play to make sure that in the moment you actually make the right choice. And we're all different, right? We have different habits. We respond different to different things. So understanding what actually works for you and making sure that we have the right nudges in place, I think is going to be a big game changer when it comes to the diet.
I think the intent gap, right? I mean, all of us work hard, right? And many of us work hard. You get home at the end of the day, you're tired. Yeah. You still have to make decisions about what you're going to eat for the night. So those nudge kind of interventions around designing your immediate home environment, for example, or workplace environment, so that the healthy choice is sort of default and easy choice, it fits with that sort of nudge thinking, yeah. Right? So one thing that my work, for example, the George Institute does, is that we regularly have fresh fruit that the work buys and just puts out on each level of the floor, so that, you know, if I'm hungry, I've been sitting at a desk for a couple of hours, get up, there's a banana, there's an apple, right? It seems simple, but it really kind of takes away some of that temptation, if you like, in terms of, I may have had a moment of weakness, but I can just reach for that fruit and, you know, that's going to be good for me.
You can't just walk around holding your breath all the time, right? It's got to be the path of least resistance. Otherwise, you sort of just have to be like willpower all the time.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do think that we need to think about our healthcare system in a very different way. And that's one of the reasons why food in connection to that healthcare is so important, because you and I, Jason, we spoke about this previously as well, and we actually don't have a healthcare system in Australia or in the world, right? We have a sickness system, of an injury system. If anything happens to you, that's where you go. And now I think the exciting part, and that's the opportunity that we have, is when we actually start to think about more integrative care, right? The preventative side of it, the recovery side of it. And when we think about integration, I think food has a massively important role to play. The answer is not more hospitals, more doctors, right? We can do so much more in the preventative side. And that has, as you mentioned, a lot of different levers and a lot of different players, which is again one of the reasons why I like the job that I have, is the ecosystem that we can actually bring together to jointly, collectively start to make a difference there.
Yeah, so much of our discourse around health the last 2 years has been on a communicable disease, a specific communicable disease, but actually this non-communicable diseases, preventing those before they get to the stage where someone needs to be in hospital, is it's not just good for individuals, it's really good for a country's bottom line.
Yeah. Just on the point about we don't have a healthcare system, but a sick care, we spend $30 to $40 billion a year on treating chronic diseases, again, right? Really the top killers in our society. And that's in comparison to how much we spend on prevention, right? So public health as a whole gets about $2 billion a year, right? So in terms of, that's all public health, not just diet, right? All public health, right? So that's only about 2% of our recurrent healthcare expenditure, right? Comparable countries are New Zealand and Canada, spends about 6% of their healthcare expenditure on prevention. You see the gap there, right? Like, why are we spending so much on the treatment part of it once people are already sick, rather than putting more resources and effort into their prevention side?
So they're spending three times as much as we are in proportion to GDP on prevention. Can you see what that translates to in terms of savings?
We know that most of these population-level diet policy, you know, around prevention, so reformulation, I explained. There are other ones like, for example, fiscal measures or economic measures. You can put some taxation on some of the less healthy products and use the money that you've raised to support the healthy foods, like fruits and vegetables. There's a lot of modelling that's been done on that sort of work, right? Billions, right? Billions of saving over the, you know, population's lifetime. I think the latest figure I saw was about $3 billion over the population's lifetime. So serious money, serious saving that we could be having, and reducing the stress on the healthcare system.
Just adding to the business case component, because we often then think about the direct healthcare costs as being the big cost. But if you think about the productivity loss as well for individuals, either because they are sick or even if they are at work, still capable of working, they may not necessarily perform at the levels that we need them to perform. So in my mind, productivity costs translating into economic output is one of the bigger levers as well that we need to consider.
It can feel a bit cold to be really boiling this down to numbers, but I think people know that health is good, feels good to feel healthy.
Yeah.
But also, in addition to that, you've got these really kind of cold, hard numbers. Mm. We got lots of questions ahead of time, really great ones, and I'll put some of them to you in a minute. But we also got a lot of questions where people are like, can we talk about the health benefits of this particular nutrient or this particular antioxidant or this category of food? And I wondered whether it would be useful for us to just absolutely go back to basics of like what actually counts at a population level when we're talking about diet quality.
Really, if you look across the world in terms of dietary guidelines that are in place, right, and this is huge amounts of work that are put in by nutrition scientists who review, you know, reams and reams and volumes of evidence around bringing it all together and synthesizing. And you can really find commonalities across all these dietary guidelines done by different countries. There are things that are clearly good for us. Fruits, vegetables, whole grains, fish, lentils, and pulses, right? And in the next basket of things are the things that are sort of somewhat neutral, right? Like, they're not terrible for you, but eating more of it also isn't a good route to health, right? So these include things like butter. And I would actually put butter in that category, and we can talk about that a little bit more. some other dairy products, so milk, for example, right? And cheeses probably fall in that category as well. Unprocessed meats, so you're kind of like poultry, red meat, they kind of fall in that sort of neutral basket again, right? I'm not saying that they're good for you, they're just in the neutral basket. And then there are things that are clearly terrible. Sugary drinks, processed meats, your salamis, your sausages, they've got tons of preservatives and salt added to them. You've also got things like really refined carbohydrate-rich products, right, which really dominate our supermarket shelves across most countries. So things like highly processed and refined breakfast cereals, white bread, for example, those things are clearly what you want to stay away from. So if you look across these kinds of dietary guidelines, that's really the consistent theme that comes out of it. And most of it these days is we'll emphasize on plant-based foods, right? Rich in plant-based foods with an occasional amount of animal protein sources. So that, I think, is at the heart of, you know, in terms of what, if people want a dietary advice, that's what I tell people every time. Focus on those food groups. When you eat like that, it also means that naturally you're getting loads of antioxidants, loads of the good things that you want in terms of the beneficial nutrients. It'll be naturally pretty low in things like saturated fat, trans fats, and salt by following those kinds of dietary patterns.
So let's talk about, we know that that's good. And like you say, it's not really a massive surprise that we've fiddled around the edges of things like the food pyramid and that sort of thing, but the fundamentals of it haven't really changed in decades. So what can we do to help people make those choices, because we've talked about the fact that it's not often the natural choice. Like, what can business do and what can governments do to actually advance this? Vanessa?
I might start with, because I think each player has a different role to play, and all will need to shift in the, and many actually are already shifting. So if I start with food companies, the one in your bucket around the more processed components and sugary drinks as an example, one of the journeys that those organizations are on is around reformulation. So they really truly recognize that is causing harm to society in a way that they never intended to do. So they've been building reformulations as well as portion controls into their portfolios. They're shifting their portfolios towards healthier goods, and they've been on that journey for years and years. Still more to do, right? That's one of the sets of players. Another player that I think has an incredibly important role is the retailer in terms of curating what is actually available when I walk into a store. So that's to do with square meters that you actually dedicate to healthy product. It's to do with promotional activities where you place certain products. There is a supermarket in the Netherlands, so my background is from the Netherlands. And one of the things that they've been doing with their private label is that they've actually extracted over the last few years a billion cubes of sugar out of their products because they recognize the role and the responsibility that they have. And they go further than that as well to actually say, look, we've got an educational role. So they have nutri-scorecards, for instance, that they place on products. They have articles that they produce. They have meal advice, for instance, to get people to understand that actually healthier food does not equal more expensive food, because that's an important myth that I think we really truly need to bust as well. And they just give you tips to make it easier to make the actual right choice, the healthy choice, the obvious and the easy choice for you.
Jason, I suspect, is that enough?
the food industry is such a heterogeneous, there's obviously a diversity of people in that space, all the way through from individual farmers to retailers to food manufacturers. And I do applaud people who want to, in an industry, who want to do their part to help improve public health. But I think what's really lacking, in Australia in particular, is government leadership. We absolutely need much, much stronger government leadership. Let's just use COVID again as a comparator. I gave the number up front in terms of globally, right? We're talking 11 million premature deaths caused by suboptimal diets, right? Since the COVID pandemic, 6 million people have died, right? When it comes to diet, it's every year. Why aren't politicians, why aren't people who are responsible for healthcare shouting from the rooftop saying, a crisis is on our hands, right? This is a real problem. And the way to tackle a crisis is you've got to commit all your resources into the fight, right? Not just sort of piecemeal solutions here and there. And I think food industry has a part to play, but the government needs to take that leadership, you know, both from local, state to national government, to say we need to have comprehensive policies and plans in place that supports the individual, that supports the communities, right? Workplaces, schools, that supports healthcare. We can come back to talk about a bit more what healthcare can do specifically around this area, but also more broadly, you know, how can we shift this, turn this ship around, so to speak?
Yeah. And I think that the government is starting to recognise that. I'm with you, isn't there so much more to do? But we've got levers like taxation, you've got levers like grants and subsidies. And if you think about the government as an institute, they're actually a massive procurer of food as well, as in the food that goes into schools, in public hospitals, and actually their own buildings as well. So they have a lot of levers to pull to actually make that change.
That's really interesting, because what I wanted, we were talking about reformulation, it's important, but it's also a really easy one to look at. And there's a real narrative around taking things out, like take out sugar, take out salt. But what I'm hearing you say is it's so important to put in fruit and vegetables, put in fish and healthy nuts and seeds and that sort of thing. So what are the strategies around that?
It comes down to individual institutions' commitments, I think, right? We can all do this. And I'll give you three examples at varying levels. So at my work, again, at the George Institute, we've had a policy in place for, I think, 4 years now. We worked with our administrative staff. We had meetings with the whole institute to say, look, you know, it's really important for us as healthcare leaders.
Yeah,
I don't want to be the food police, right? But it's also really, really important for us to think about when we spend our institute's dollars to procure our office lunches or work meeting lunches, let's, again, not saying that it's black and white, right? But let's just shift the proportion. So instead of always having a cake with those workplace lunches, maybe we'll only have it once every 2 months. That's a good example. We've now taken it to a next step here at UNSW, actually, where we've got a good food project, which runs hand in hand with the sustainability element as well, right? So reducing single-use plastic, don't use takeaway cups. But at the same time, right, putting in some institutional guidance or leadership to say to the individual retailers on campus to say, hey, again, work with us. We're doing the research around it. We're helping people to look at what are the things that you're selling right now. What are the sort of kinds of practices in your stores that could be improved? For example, for your 2-to-1 lunch deals, we're talking about a bunch of students, a lot of students here who are in particular very budget conscious, right?
For sure.
So can we make sure some of those deals are targeted towards water plus a salad or water plus a sandwich, right? Something that is going to be healthy and affordable at the same time. So those are the kind of examples, I think. We're at a fairly local level, but we can go all the way up through to, you know, local government can do the same thing, right? So ACT, for example, have said on our buses, on our public buses, we will not have advertising for certain kinds of junk foods, right? So saying that, again, you know, you feel free to put those advertising out other places you like, but here where it's government property, we will stop that, those kinds of advertising. So there is just such a diverse mixture of policies that all kinds of stakeholders can put in place and have a real impact all the way from the local to the national level.
Food service companies, as an example, they have a massive role to play as well, right? So they provide the food and the meal curation. And the narrative and the value proposition that they build around that, I think, is starting to shift quite dramatically. And we talked about business case earlier. One of the really beautiful things that I'm seeing coming through from food service companies is that they're actually going to talk about the benefits of healthy eating over and above just not getting sick. Mm-hmm. So that is to do with your mind, your productivity, as an example. So professional service services firms like Deloitte, we need our people to really think clearly. And even safety, I know that many of the food companies who supply food to mining corporations, for instance, the big risk there is safety of individuals. We know that if we give them better food, that safety incidents drop because people are concentrating better, right? So there's lots of ways in which we can start to shift the narrative towards the why of healthier eating and then making sure that it's indeed then affordable and available, which is your other point earlier. And then when we actually do get to a hospital, God forbid something might end up happening to you, then the food has another role to play in my mind, and that's another lever that we haven't pulled sufficiently. I'm not sure how often you visit a hospital, but if you then look at what's actually being offered, irrespective of why you're there and what condition you actually have, it's the same. And it's not necessarily that healthy, right? So how we actually think about curating meals and hopefully then also targeting the specific needs of those individuals based on their medical condition, I think is a massive one. And then subsequently, when they're an outpatient or recovery, what is the advice that we're giving them and equip them to actually then subsequently take care of themselves to either speed up recovery or hopefully reverse some of the impacts that it's had. Jason, you and I were talking earlier. I think you're on the verge of an awesome initiative. Maybe you want to talk about that.
We've talked, I think, a lot so far about initiatives that almost happens outside of healthcare, right? We've talked a lot about businesses, we've talked about individual institutions taking leadership. But if you think about healthcare itself, right? So we spend billions and billions into paying for medications, surgeries, right? These kinds of services, they're vital, don't get me wrong, very, very important. But when it comes to supporting people to eat healthier, it stops at, well, we're just going to talk to you about it. Why don't we actually put some of their healthcare dollars into paying and subsidizing for healthy foods and evidence-based healthy meals? Because we know that structural barriers to healthy eating, accessibility, affordability, why don't our healthcare systems actually set up, you know, to be able to have those programs in place? And in the United States, this is already a reality, so we're probably a good 5 to 10 years behind the US. There are programs called produce prescription, so doctors literally prescribe people with type 2 diabetes, people who experience food insecurity, to say, I think you need this probably a bit more than getting another medication to treat your condition. And there's some very, very promising data now that's accumulating to say actually it can be very effective. It can also be cost-saving. So people who are put onto these, supported by these kinds of programs, have overall reduced healthcare expenditure. So not only is it good for the person, the individuals, but also good for the healthcare system as a whole. So here in Australia, we're now embarking on a number of programs. We're starting to roll out, you know, testing these interventions in mostly focused on New South Wales right now, but hopefully we'll be able to scale it in the future.
Can we talk about that and dig in a little bit on that? Because so much of what we hear is about, well, we can sit here and talk about it. It's really important for people to eat like fruit and vegetables, and we live in capital cities and we have resources and not every Australian has access to it. So ensuring food security and equity of access is so important.
You started off with the food and veg being important. I think one stat that is still astounding for me, and this is an Australian one, is that 90% of us actually do not get the daily intake of food and veg, right? So let's start with that. We've got a deficiency full stop that we need to address. But the reasons as to why we're not accessing that is different. And I think your comment around the vulnerable communities, lower income, perhaps rural as well, it's often a combination of both accessibility and then affordability. It's not about the willingness, as in even if you wanted to actually have healthy food, you may not necessarily get it. And I think that's a big challenge that we need to address. And I think government in particular will have a role to play in terms of curating from an urban planning perspective, for instance, the different types of shops or stores that you want to open, subsidizing access to the certain food, the infrastructure itself. Because particularly if we're talking rural, for instance, if you look at some of the food prices, which today's news around inflation actually brings that to the fore again, we know that in rural areas, it is even more costly to actually access food. And that's often also where the population of vulnerable parts of our society actually reside.
what we think will work and what we have shown can work in the metropolitan areas may not work for communities that are further out. So local agriculture, you know, is there a role for providing training to the communities, providing support by the government just to make sure that the foods don't have to travel as far, right, before it can get to them. Supply chain logistics, right, and that's where I think food businesses can have, they're the experts in terms of making sure things can get from A to B at the lowest cost and in the best condition possible. So, you know, that's definitely an area that needs a lot of work.
One of the questions that we've got that's come through sort of plays to this idea of food security. Peter Jennings is asking, at what point is the population going to outstrip our ability to basically meet the demand for food? What do we know about our ability to make food for the number of humans that we've got on this planet?
Right now, for the population that we have more than enough calories to meet everyone's needs. So the main issue actually lies with distribution. Going forward, I think it's going to be very challenging. And this is, you know, going back to the sustainability issue as well, right? We know that the way that we produce our food and the way that our food system currently works is actually also a major driver of climate breakdown. We know we're already on the cusp of we've experienced all these droughts, all these flooding recently, that we know it is, you know, there's a high likelihood it's been driven by climate catastrophe that's happening. So whether we can sustain the level of production that's going to be needed to meet everyone's needs, there's an interplay there in terms of both how we produce, how we transport our food and all of that, together with our ability to be able to continue to thrive going into the future.
For me, it's also the production and the way that food is being produced that we need to tackle. That has massive destructive implications to the planet. It's the monocropping, it's the agricultural revolution which started many, many years ago with really good intent, right? It was to make sure that malnutrition actually came down, which we succeeded in doing by industrializing all of it. We're now seeing that it had lots of side effects and actually malnutrition is going up. So we might not necessarily been able to claim some of these benefits that we had for a short period of time. So I do think, again, that's where the food and agricultural industry can do a lot. We're seeing regenerative ag practices coming through, which then harnesses biodiversity. It's technology as well that is able to actually help us there. And as much as tech, I think in food can help the climate component, it actually is also really interesting, again, for the health of individuals. Because when we think about how we manage our own health, technology, in my mind, is going to revolutionize that big time. And I'm wearing a watch at the moment, so there's a lot that is being measured about me, and there are lots more other technologies out there that could measure my state and actually give me prompters in terms of what I need, what my body needs. And that's an exciting space. That's precision nutrition and personalized nutrition that we can get into. One awesome example that I've seen, and it's currently within the UK in particular, it's a company called DNA Nudge. It basically is a bracelet, and it uses your DNA, or well, saliva in this case. So it's a relatively non-invasive part. It's not going down your stool or your blood, but it's your saliva. And based on that, they understand what your microbiome is. And if you wear that bracelet and you actually go out shopping, and you can shop at Tesco or Waitrose, you can scan the product and your bracelet will tell you that based on your DNA, that product is good or not good for you, and actually can give you prompters in terms of what alternatives would be better for you. So if you combine all of these awesome technological advancements with the science of what we now know about individuals' body, and then put on top of that the behavioral economics that we can actually prompt you to say, I know exactly what you respond to, because Jason, you're someone, if there is a competitive gaming component, you're on top of the ladder, you'll be much more likely to actually nudge in that way. And because I know that about you, I can tailor my engagement with you in a way that actually works.
But we can't have 7 billion people with smartwatches telling them what to eat. So, this sense maybe where the rich get richer. It's incredible that we're able to do this stuff. It's amazing. That's precision nutrition, like precision medicine. But what about the rest of us?
Yeah. I'm a little bit skeptical on the precision nutrition. You know, we can talk about the literature there a little bit more. It's at an early stage. I think a lot more research needs to be done. And what I worry about a little bit there is the unintended side consequences, is that, again, we lose sight of the big picture. We lose sight of it. Just using microbiome as an example, because I get asked this all the time. What should I eat to help the bugs, right? All these trillions of bacteria.
Fruit and vegetables.
Right? And I hate to sound so boring, but the kind of foods, right, that probiotics that we use to feed the microbiome, essentially fermentable fiber. And guess what we get the fermentable fiber from?
Fruit and vegetables.
Fruit and vegetables and whole grains, right? So it's, I just don't want folks to lose sight of that big picture, which is we already know, like, sort of 80% of the way, I would say, we have a pretty good picture of the roadmap to health and well-being when it comes to diet. Absolutely, like room for additional research around supporting specific conditions. And then I also worry about that the implication for driving inequity. We really need to have, again, those system-wide interventions that's going to help lift everybody, as opposed to only the folks who can afford it.
Yeah, no, we do. I'm not arguing with you on that one. But what I love about just knowing more and education in the broader sense, right? So precision nutrition has that part of the spectrum, but obviously basic knowledge is there. But for me, feeling empowered as a consumer that you know what's right for you, and then not being worried about affordability, which is why I think food, cost of food, we will need to look into and continue to look into. That's the ultimate key, I think, to unlocking so much potential.
Yeah, so let's talk about food as medicine. Like, there's the prevention side of things, and then there's also the kind of recovery side of things, which you sort of alluded to a bit. We talked a bit about prevention of things like diabetes, hypertension, you know, sugar and salt. What other sort of things are there on the prevention end and then the recovery end?
A good example of a dietary pattern that's really effective for reducing blood pressure and therefore preventing future risk of heart attacks and strokes. It's called the DASH diet, right? Diet approach to stop hypertension, right? So nice and succinct, right? If you look at that dietary pattern again, so definitely, you know, fruits and vegetables, whole grains, healthy dairy, so low-fat dairy products as part of the dietary pattern, because dairy products not only is it contain lots of healthy nutrients, potassium is a particular component that's important that you get quite a bit of from dairy, and it helps lower your blood pressure. The DASH diet also talks about obviously keeping an eye on your salt intake, right? So make sure that you don't have too much salt. And that's been proven again and again, right? And in hundreds of trials, it shows that even within a short time period, right, 4 weeks, 4 to 6 weeks, you can see reduction in an amount of blood pressure for people with hypertension and also just the general population. To be honest, when it comes to recovery, the healthy sort of foods that are good for us really don't change a huge amount. Again, there's cultural sensitivity and specificity. Of course, we always need to keep in mind what foods people are actually going to consume and they're going to enjoy eating. But really, the basic dietary pattern don't change a lot.
I'm glad, though, that you could pointed out some of the benefits of dairy as an example, because the danger is when we say it's neutral, and if you're putting it in a neutral bucket, that we actually don't necessarily need it, and it's all about fruit and veg, because I just want to make sure that actually do we have foods within that neutral bucket that are critically important, right? Red meat as an example, we know it also is being debated.
Just quick qualified, dairy is part of that healthy dietary plan. It's not on its own.
Because there are lots of components, and I think people may not necessarily fully appreciate what the benefits of these products are. And just a glass of milk as an example, if you are a runner, marathon runners as an example, they might take a product that has electrolytes in it at the end, a sugary type product, but actually milk might have more electrolytes, a glass of milk, than one of those specific sport drinks might have, right? Not many people know about that. So as much as I like your simple view, I think there's lots to be done still around educating them on the benefits beyond food and veg.
Also, it was interesting you mentioned cultural factors, or one of you did at least. People would like to say food is fuel, but it's not. It's memories and culture and connection and comfort, for better or worse, and yes, it's fuel as well. And how that plays into these conversations we have, especially when we're talking to different cultural groups and trying to educate people.
As countries tend to go through that development or economic development trajectory, more and more we shift towards a quote-unquote Western dietary pattern, which is dominated by packaged and processed foods, more meat-based products. There is a commonality, again, in terms of even if you go back to most countries in terms of their traditional diet, there's an element of that. A lot of it is healthy, right? A lot of it can be culturally appropriate because people are used to eating those kinds of foods.
We do hear a lot about the Mediterranean diet, but essentially there's so many commonalities. Yeah. It's just really well studied. Yes. Sorry, Vanessa, you go though.
No, I love where you went with saying it's more than fuel, right? And food is emotion. And that's the part that I love and the reason why I love food, because we share it with others, we understand the food. And I also think that that is one of the areas where we can do a lot more with societies to connect them to the story of food and connect them to the land and where it's from. And the more you understand, the more you start to appreciate it and the more value that the sharing of that would have. So that's another area that I think opens up a lot of opportunities. And having long supply chains that we currently have in the world, which is basically a result of that industrialized agriculture where you say we're going to produce the food in the most economic parts of the world, which is also why you have the calories unevenly distributed, that played a part and provided us with benefits. But I think it's time for us to actually start to get back to food, back to the land, and start to produce food more locally as well.
And we'll start with this question, who says, I try to avoid preservatives, but are they as bad as I think they are?
There's a whole diverse range of things that people use in food. So it's a bit hard to just kind of say blanketly they're all bad for you. But absolutely, I would say, you know, look, if you pick up a packaged food product and you turn the packet around, you look at the ingredients list, and it's full of 1,000 ingredients, most of which you can't pronounce, there's probably a good chance that I would personally say that's probably not the route to the optimum nutrition, right? And a lot of those would be preservatives that when it comes to processed meats, for example, there's pretty good evidence that you know, eating more processed meats leads to all kinds of chronic diseases, and it's quite likely it's due to types of preservatives that are found in the meat products, right? Nitrates and sodium, for example.
Mm. Is that something that industry is working on reducing, or is that something that can come into reformulation, or are they a necessity if we've got things that are packaged and processed?
Yeah, well, it depends is the answer, but there's already, with the rise of the health conscious consumer, there are already trends around getting towards more natural products or less of or free from, right? We had a whole trend for a while that basically advertised a product not with what's actually in the packet, but what is not in the packet, right? So I would definitely say that that's a continuation. But look, it was a hard question to get. You did a great job in answering, but I think there's a bit of a simplistic view that we can bring to that as well. It's basically saying if you do it in moderation, you should actually be fine. It's when there is a degree of over use that we start to actually see the issues arise from a healthcare perspective.
Yeah, similarly, because there's a theme here, another person saying that they hear that there are insufficient vitamins in food, and so should we be taking supplements? Which vitamins are the key for living longer?
Look, if you eat what is, again, the dietary guideline recommended kind of dietary pattern, you should never have to worry about being vitamin deficient. For the general public, there are specific times and people with specific conditions or even dietary approaches that they follow where supplements are called for. So pregnant women with folic acid, that's a good example, right? So supplements do play a role for specific populations. People who are vegan, vegetarians, you first of all, you need to think very carefully about making sure that you are nutritionally complete and you're meeting all the micronutrient requirements. And sometimes, again, supplements could be useful for people who are vegans or vegetarians, for example. Just a couple of examples, right? Iron, vitamin B12 as well. But really, though, overall, the use of multivitamins, for example, there's very little evidence to suggest that, again, it's going to be useful preventing these major diseases we're talking about, cardiovascular disease, cancer, type 2 diabetes. A major trial was just published about 2 months ago, again, another 20,000 people, right, randomized to take multivitamin or not, and what they found is that nada, right? Like 5-year, 6-year study, long-term follow-up. So overall, I would say, you know, if you really want to, in terms of improving your overall health and well-being, think about your overall dietary pattern, a little bit less attention on the supplements. Otherwise, you just end up getting what I think was ABC actually covered. You're saying very expensive urine.
Sounds good.
But it does have a role to play. And as you say, it can never replace a healthy diet. That is the first thing. But we also know that we've got 90% of the people not actually getting access to a full healthy diet. So there is a deficiency in nutrients that supplement can play a role in. The other part is that certain medical conditions might actually require you to get access to certain vitamins or supplements or nutrients that are in doses far beyond what you could ever get out of a diet. And that's something to consider as well. It's an industry that is growing massively as part of that whole conscious consumer trend that we're seeing. We're now spending more on supplements and well-being related product than we do on prescription medicine. And that's for the first time that we're seeing that shift taking place. And I don't see it slowing down either. But what I do like to see, what we're already seeing, and it comes back to some of that personalized component, is you don't always know what you're deficient of and therefore what type of products actually suit you. And without knowing that, you might end up taking things that create expensive urine to stay within your description.
And actually potentially for active harm. So there's a really famous research, really, in the sense that people used to think beta-carotene, which is the kind of chemical you get from colorful vegetables like carrots, is the best example. Yeah. And because there were observations that people who had more beta-carotene in their diet, maybe a lower risk in observational studies, right, that they had lower risk of developing lung cancer. But then people did an actual randomized controlled trial, and the group that received the beta-carotene actually had higher risk, right, of developing lung cancer. And then people went, whoa. Like, I tell that story because the reductionism can be not only not just neutral, like it can actually be actively harmful. So we need to actually be quite careful. I think getting the help of health professionals, or seeing your dietitian, seeing your healthcare provider and say, do I actually need to take supplements, is definitely a good starting point. But also don't, I guess it's important to keep in mind that it isn't necessarily just neutral for you as well. It could actually lead to harm too.
We've actually got a couple of people asking similar questions along the lines of, like, must a healthy diet be expensive?
There's this misconception out there that it is cheaper for you to go for unhealthier food, particularly when some of the quick service restaurants have certain deals on and look like, hey, I can feed my entire family for this. And therefore, if I were to actually go to a supermarket, it would be more expensive. Reality is that if you look at the studies that are taking place on that topic, including the ones here in Australia, there is no proof that there is a disconnect between one being more expensive than the other. But it is to do with understanding how you can actually feed your family healthy in a way that is affordable and doable. So I think there's a lot to do, again, around the advice and education, curation of meals, and in particular for a grocery player as well to have a role within that.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. There's also an issue around how you measure the cost of diet, right? So if you go down purely to a caloric-based metric, some of the ultra-processed, really unhealthy foods can appear to, because that's basically all they're packed on. It's just there are no other useful nutrients but packed full of just pure
energy.
Calories, right?
Yeah.
But if you take a broader picture in terms of, well, we know the things that are good for us are these, you know, useful phytonutrients and antioxidants. If you take that broader view in terms of calculating, you know, cost of diet based on what's going to give you what your body really needs, then you can get a very different picture. So yes, I agree. There's no evidence that, at least the evidence that we have so for now, you know, that it's absolutely more expensive to eat a healthier diet.
If we were to make one big change in the next 5-10 years, what do you think it should be to actually have the biggest effect on Australians' health? We'll start with you, Vanessa.
I would say it's to do with that empowered consumer being able to actually make the healthy choice, the obvious choice. And education to begin with is a good starting point.
Just to leverage off that theme, I would like folks to think of ourselves as more than just consumers. We are citizens, we're advocates, we can all play a role in trying to fix our food system. So in addition to educating yourself, use your wallet to purchase foods from your local food provider, you know, think about the individual companies where you're buying from, what are their practices like. You can take leadership in your workplace, in your schools, you know, push for change to say, I want food to be center of what we do as an organization. That's right there in the agenda mix. Think more than just being a consumer.
You've been listening to Food on the Frontline of Health from the University of New South Wales Faculty of Medicine and Health. The speakers were Jason Wu, University of New South Wales Professor and Head of Nutrition Science at the George Institute for Global Health, and Vanessa Mathiasen, Deloitte's National Consumer Products Lead and the lead author of their Future of Food series. The host was Tegan Taylor, ABC science journalist. With food, it's not only quality, it's quantity. We waste mountains of food here in Australia and in other developed countries. It's lost or wasted at all points along the food chain, in production, distribution, processing, and in the household. Dr. Christian Reynolds is a senior lecturer at the Centre for Food Policy at City University London. In this Big Ideas broadcast in March, he spoke to Chris McIlwain, a teaching fellow in the University of New South Wales Faculty of Law and Justice.
Let's get the headline statistics out the way. From what we know, about one third of food never reaches a human stomach. So that means it's going somewhere else in the food system. That could be it's going towards animal feed or into, say, bio-oils or things like that. But a majority of that is also going as loss or waste. So there's a kind of definitional thing around loss and waste, and we might get to that in a little bit of time. But if we're thinking of it in terms of, say, climate change, because I think that's a hot topic, we can think about the food system as a whole contributing around 26 to 30%, depending on the accounting method you use, for climate impacts. 26 to 30% of global climate emissions per year are due to our food system. Food loss and waste, because of slight differences in impacts, is equivalent to about 8% of climate emissions. So food that is wasted, not going into human mouths, not having a purpose, being left to rot, being a waste of resources, is about 8% of our global climate emissions. So that's a staggering amount. So if we want to fix our climate change, if we want to fix our food system for multiple reasons, looking at food loss and waste is a prime way to start changing other things within our food system. And that's the big reason we need to look at it. But in each country as well, there are different drivers, because food loss and waste means a loss or a waste of resources, so fertilizers, inputs. It means a loss of time of people working in the food sector, chopping things, taking them, farming them, growing them, that is then wasted. So there's multiple reasons for actually wanting to reduce food waste and reduce food loss there.
The numbers are staggering. Work by WWF UK and UNEP in 2021 was finding 1.2 billion tonnes lost on farms and 900 million tonnes lost in the rest of the food system. So that's about 2.1 billion tonnes.
For us as individuals, these are inconceivable amounts of food waste. So I used to work for a global food loss and waste charity called the Waste Resources Action Program, or the shorthand of RAP. And we used to, you know, say, this is this number of buses or this number of Wembley stadiums. But even then, it becomes numbers that are so big that they just lose all meaning. So I used to volunteer pre-COVID, of course, at a food rescue organization. So we would be taking food from supermarkets that was at its best before. So it was still safe to eat, but it was not fit for sale anymore for quality reasons. And they will be redistributing that, if it's vegetables or bread, to people in need. But even the amount we were getting from one or two local supermarkets still was too much for us as a low, small funded charity to process. And so even at that level of local individual, it blows my mind in terms of the amount of food that's coming. And if we think of that in terms of supermarket waste, for instance, that's an extremely efficient system. And for supermarket waste, we're thinking only about 4 to 5%, depending where we are in the world. In Australia and UK, it's around 4 to 5% of supermarket waste is wasted, because they don't want to waste food. They want to have profit. They want to sell it to people. And so even that amount there, which is a very small amount for the supermarkets, is a staggering amount for other people to process and realize is food waste. And if we think in terms of the unseen food waste, the staggering statistic for, say, Australia and the UK is about 1 in 4 to 1 in 5 bags of food you bring into your home on average goes to waste. So that means that you're wasting 1/4 or 1/5 of your weekly food budget by it just being wasted, which is a staggering amount of waste there. And that's unseen or not noticed by many people. So much of the research I've done or others have done, such as Professor David Evans, has shown that people just don't notice this waste happening until you actually start making them alert to it and making them realize that this waste occurs, and then they start changing their behavior. But there is good news. We can do something there.
We'll get to some solutions shortly, but where's it occurring, say, in developed countries? Whereabouts in the food system are we seeing it? You've mentioned that households are a big source.
food waste happens across the entire food supply chain. So it happens on farm. So it can even happen pre-harvest if we think about it. But let's just take it from the point of harvest, because then we know it's definitely food that's coming off the farm. It can happen there. It can then happen, say, if we're taking a vegetable, at the pack house. So it goes from the farm to a place, it gets washed, sorted. It might be a wonky shape. It might not fit specifications. It, you know, it could get knocked out and become waste there. It could then go on to a secondary processor. So it could be, say, grain being milled. There could be waste there. It travels up the chain, and there is food loss and waste at every single stage. There are inefficiencies at every stage of this food supply chain. And so there are different amounts of food waste happening at these different stages based on the type of food that it is. And so there's a combination here of what interventions or things we can enact in terms of policy or things we can do with different groups to actually change the amounts of food loss and waste based on where it's happening. But if you're wanting, say, an overall answer, households are contributing 30 to 40% of per country food loss and waste. But then you also have food loss and waste in each other part of the chain. So hospitality has an amount, supermarkets, as I've said, about 5% of total turnover is lost or wasted, depending on which supermarket and what products you're talking about. So there's large amounts at different points of the chain. So there's lots of these system-wide complexities in terms of how you solve food loss and waste. But overall, it's spread throughout. But in all countries now, households, whether it's developed, developing, wherever you are, households are one of the big factors of food loss and waste. But we shouldn't blame the consumer there, because there are system-based lock-ins, which I'm sure we'll come to, that mean that the consumers are locked into wasting a certain amount of food. So that could be packs, portion size, etc. But I'm sure we'll come to that in a second.
Maybe you might want to talk about the Sustainable Development Goals, and in particular 12.3, and how that's been a driver for action.
The Sustainable Development Goals are global goals that are set for sustainability to end in 2030. The goal 12.3 is broken down into two parts. Part one says we need to halve food waste by 2030. Part two says, and reduce food loss. Now, the really powerful thing about SDG, or Sustainable Development Goal 12.3, is they have a group behind them called Champions 12.3, which is a body of actors, or a group of international CEOs, of activists, of people from all walks of life who are getting behind this to say, in my company, I am signing a pledge to help mobilize my, you know, my company, my efforts towards being an ambassador to make 12.3 happen. Back when the SDGs, the Sustainable Development Goals, first came out, the Champions Group made a business case for food loss and waste reduction. And so they said that we need to actually show all businesses that it's worth their while to reduce food loss and waste. And the powerful thing is they've come out with a study that shows, so this is in American dollars, I know not Australian dollars, but there's a 14 to 1 payback ratio in some hospitality industries. And overall, it's a 7 to 1 payback ratio throughout more of the food system, in terms of for every dollar, whether it's US or Australian, I guess, or pound if you're in the UK, you put into food waste, there's a 14 or 7-fold return on investment of that in terms of reducing food waste. One of the Australian government ambitions is to reduce food waste by 2030 by half. And so one of the big things that I've been working on over the last year is supporting FIAL in doing some of the modelling to see, can, with what policy mixes we need to actually reduce food loss and waste to meet that goal. The Australian government and Australians in general have it within their capacity to actually get to 52% food waste reduction if we, did a sensible policy mix. If we threw the kitchen sink at food waste, we could by 2030 reduce it further. But that would be, you know, switching everything that we could, thinking about it day and night. But I think a more reasonable thing is there's a lot of change that needs to happen within the next 2 to 3 years, but we can do that. For Australia as a nation, reducing food waste makes economic sense, it makes climate sense, and it makes water sense. There's all of these tick boxes that we can have there.
Dr. Christian Reynolds, Senior Lecturer at the Centre for Food Policy at City University London. You can hear the full program by clicking the link on the Big Ideas homepage. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for your company. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.